This week on Making Contact.
The coyotes, the guys, go on top the tree and look at with the cell phone. They talk, okay, you can come, okay, go, go, go. Everything is fast.
Immigration reform is the hot button issue in the U.S. Just ask your colleagues, friends, or family, and you're certain to spark a debate about what should be done with 12 million undocumented people working and living in this country. In fact, the U.S. Congress remains deadlocked over the issue, each side unable to hammer out a compromise that makes sense. So why is there so much debate? On this edition, people who've risked their lives to enter the U.S. undocumented share their personal stories of why they came and what they hope for their futures and the future of immigrants in this country. I'm Tina Rubio, your host on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. No one knows for sure exactly how many people have died at the U.S.-Mexico border. The U.S. Border Patrol and immigrant watch groups offer up a variety of statistics. And that fact alone tells us all we need to know about the perilous situation unfolding every day at the southern edges of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. Since 2000, some watch groups report that more than 2,400 migrants have died attempting to cross over, the majority of those deaths occurring in Arizona. For the Tucson area alone, more than 100 people have died as of June 2006, many from heat exhaustion and dehydration. And for those who do make it, the experience is often traumatic and demoralizing. Making Contact's Nancy Han reports from Tucson, bringing us the story of immigrants caught and sent back after hours of walking in the desert, the Border Patrol agents trying to catch them, and the human rights advocates trying to help them.
A 20-year-old woman we'll call Alicia sits in a tent in a dry dirt lot, her blistered feet in a basin of water.
Right now we're going to go rest because we have injuries in our feet and it hurts a lot.
Alicia and her 14-year-old sister, both from Oaxaca, walked through the Arizona desert for 18 hours before being caught by the U.S. Border Patrol and returned to Mexico. The scene looks like a refugee camp. Dozens of tired, dusty men, women, and children stand in line for a bottle of water and a burrito in a plastic bag. The makeshift aid station is set up just a few steps across the border in Nogales, Mexico, an hour south of Tucson. Alicia was limping when she arrived, just off the Border Patrol bus.
I don't know, about a quarter of her foot is already exposed, open blisters, and in between each of the toes is already, the skin has already came off from the blisters, and once the blisters pop, it's when the infection starts to occur.
A young man from Florida, who goes by the name Waffle, kneels on the ground in front of Alicia, applying antibiotic ointment to her feet with a Q-tip. He points to a black, inflamed spot in the side of her right foot.
So this right here is a thorn from the cactus that's stuck in her foot that needs to come out, that went through her shoe and her foot. Okay, no mas.
Waffle is one of six volunteers here to provide food, water, first aid, and information to the 300 to 500 people returned through this port every day.
Someone can also be in charge of handing out water and handing out burritos. So if someone wants to do burritos, they want to.
Debbie Weingarten. I am the volunteer coordinator for No More Deaths.
No More Deaths is a Tucson-based human rights group that set up the aid station here.
Because it's clear that hundreds and thousands of people are being repatriated through the ports of entries, and our medical professionals are pretty convinced that one of the largest reasons for the deaths in the desert are because people are returned in such compromised health, and they must again start out across the desert having not received any medical attention while they've been in custody.
That's exactly what happened to Alicia and her sister. We'll call her Yvette. When they started out this time, they already had blisters from their first try, 3 days earlier.
The first time we walked 15 hours, and the second time 18.
got really bad blisters in between her toes where it's rubbed. She's in a lot of pain. She's 14 years old.
Yvette's feet are wrinkled and swollen with bulging blisters that look like fried pork rinds. Not all the migrants need medical care. Many just need orientation. It's 3 miles into town from this dusty commercial port, and most people returned here are not from this area of Mexico. They may have no idea where they are, how to get help, or where to go to rest, call home, regroup, and decide what to do next.
Hey, Debbie, is there shelters here in town?
Volunteers also ask people how they were treated by the Border Patrol. They say many migrants report physical or verbal abuse, but are afraid to make a formal report. Several people in this group report feeling intimidated or threatened by agents. Alicia says in spite of long hours walking in over 90-degree heat, in spite of the dangers of the desert, she suffered more in the Border Patrol's detention center.
Se siente uno abandonado.
You feel abandoned, really alone, because we're not criminals. We just want them to give us an opportunity to stay and work and to see that so many people are against you. They yell at you or they push you.
She says one agent told her if she tried to come back, he would find her, turned into a skeleton. Another woman in the group says she was threatened too. 29-year-old Delmi from Yucatan and her 9-year-old son are trying to get to San Francisco, where Delmi has lived and worked in a restaurant for the past 3 years, and where her youngest child was born.
He told me, if I intend to come back, he would take my son away from me. He would send me back by myself, and they would keep my child.
Volunteers say migrants also report being held for long periods without enough food and water.
We've seen dozens and dozens and dozens and hundreds of people that have been held for over 24 hours who've been given a package of crackers.
At the Border Patrol's Tucson Sector Headquarters, spokesman Gustavo Soto says that's not so.
No, there are very strict protocols that the Border Patrol has. One of the things our chief, Michael Nicely, has sent out in memo format instructing our agents, water and food is always provided at the station level. If a person is there for 24 hours, he received 3 meals.
And is juice and crackers considered a meal?
Not juice and crackers, but at least if a person comes in that will only spend a couple of hours, we'll give him something to make sure that he has something in his stomach. We'll ask him, when was the last time you ate? If the person's like, I haven't eaten 24 hours, let's get you into the station and we'll give you a meal, which we have ready-made meals. Something you can put in the microwave, something you can add hot water to, but it will be a meal.
And Soto says all reports of abuse are investigated.
Any allegation of misconduct against our agent is taken very, very seriously. Once an allegation is made, even if it's recanted at a later date, it's still investigated. We are probably the most watched agency out there.
The Tucson Sector Border Patrol has detained over 350,000 people, a decrease of almost 10% compared to the previous fiscal year. Soto says that's because of increased law enforcement, including deployment of National Guard troops on the border.
We're finally having that deterrent effect that we've been striving for since the beginning of the Operation Safeguard in the 1990s. The added infrastructure, technology, and manpower is finally coming to where we want to see it. The likelihood of you being apprehended now is greater than it's ever been.
But watch groups argue the increased enforcement has only made the trek more dangerous and more expensive. Alicia says she and her sister were going to pay nearly $2,500 each to get into the United States. Like most people, they have already paid part of that fee and have paid for their trip to the border with borrowed money.
That's why we have to get through. We have to pay back that money.
Francisco Jerónimo from Puebla was also on the Border Patrol bus with Alicia. Getting caught hasn't deterred him either.
Because my family depends on me. If I didn't have anyone dependent on me, why would I come here? To be humiliated? For them to treat me this way? No, we all do it for our families.
A family he has left behind.
Toda la familia lo siente. Es feo, es feo. Entonces aquí
You feel bad because you leave them, and it hurts them. It hurts the whole family. It's terrible. It's terrible. I'll tell you, we suffer here. You wouldn't believe it.
That suffering is something volunteer Jeffrey Boyce has seen on the faces of hundreds of migrants.
We talk about them in abstract ways. You know, you've got pundits in Washington, you've got industry and investors and activists even, you know, who talk about these things in really abstract terms, and they're not abstract. You know, they affect people in real, personal ways.
Boyce says offering aid for the body is also a way of offering aid for people's spirits, spirits that are often as torn up as the hundreds of blistered feet Boyce has treated since the aid stations were opened in July.
I mean, it's a really profound experience, actually. You know, it's really humbling to wash somebody's feet who's been in the desert for a long time, you know.
While Democrats and Republicans debate whether to create a guest worker program or focus primarily on border enforcement and deportation of those already living in the U.S., here in Nogales, one thing is clear. Migrants will continue to cross the border, whatever the cost, in search of jobs and the chance at a better life for their families.
I'm just finishing this bandage off and trying to get her on her way.
For Making Contact, I'm Nancy Hand.
We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. From Cold War Berlin to today's West Bank, for as long as walls have been built, separating nations and cultures, people have always found a way to make it to the other side. And no matter how tall the wall, aspirations for what is perceived as a better life outweighed the risks. That's why so many put their lives on the line each day at the U.S.-Mexico border. Making Contact, Stefana Petrova shares the story of 23-year-old Michelle, who crossed over at the Arizona border.
3 years ago, Michelle made a life-altering decision. She left her family, her friends, and her beloved homeland, Brazil, to pursue a new life in the U.S. Like so many other undocumented immigrants who come to the U.S., Michelle wanted to provide a better life for her family in Sao Paulo. But to do it, she'd have to risk her life. After paying $9,000 to a trafficking broker in Sao Paulo, Michelle began the journey that she hoped would end with her successful crossing of the U.S.-Mexico border. First by plane to Mexico City, then further north by car to the border town of Heroico Nogales, Mexico. There she found temporary shelter in a makeshift safe house just a few miles from the U.S. border, waiting for the right moment to make her crossing.
You never know. When you're in America, they say you're gonna come to the America. You never know. They say sometimes it's gonna be like 30 minutes or like 5 hours. Or I stay inside in one house waiting for the best moment for 4 days.
But eventually, that moment came.
At 4 a.m., when the police people they changed the schedule. The coyotes, the guys on top of the tree and look at with the cell phone. They talk, okay, you can come, okay, go. Everything is fast. Every day at 4 a.m. we try. We go there and the wall, the big tall wall. And then they make like a hole. And this hole they make between two mountains.
But the dash toward the U.S. did not come off as planned.
When I jump, it was the police cars coming, and they pulled me back. And they closed the holes. The police, they work there, they know all the holes they do it. They know exactly where is the holes. And it's really hard because I was like 5 minutes from America and I can't go. I have to wait. So I was thinking, how does my mom think where I am? Maybe she think I'm like I'm in the prison, or she think I'm in the desert, or where she think I am.
4 times Michelle and her group were turned back by the U.S. Border Patrol. Then, on a cold and rainy December night, Michelle crossed to the other side, finally setting foot on American soil. But things were about to take a drastic turn. Michelle found herself surrounded by U.S. Border Patrol cars. Horrified, she and her Brazilian friend hid underneath one of the cars and watched while 35 other illegal border crossers were arrested.
So I was watching, they got everybody. I was watching the police with the big lights, and I say, you know what? If they don't get us right now, they're gonna get us later. So it's cold, we are with hungry, and we can see only police car right here. Let's go. And then we get off under the car, and I stand up my hands, crying, because in this moment, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I lost it. You know, what I'm gonna do now? My situation more bad.
But Michelle's nightmare was just beginning. Border Patrol officers took her into custody. She says she was fingerprinted, photographed, and interrogated for hours in a field office. Then she was put on the bus with several other women, handcuffed to the seat, and was taken to another locale. There she was ordered to disrobe and was subjected to a full body cavity search.
They're looking for drugs inside the vagina. They know doing nothing delicate. It was like, it's hurt a lot. And I was crying because my family is from church in Brazil. And I never think I'm gonna, and this time I was thinking, Jesus Christ, what I'm doing here? What I'm past for just being in America? I know America is like, we can do money, I can help my family. Why they have to do this, you know? I know I'm gonna be really old and I'm gonna remember this.
After the cavity search, she was back on the bus. No one told them where they were headed to next. It turns out they were taken to an immigration detention facility in Tucson, where she and the other women were locked up in a crowded room.
Just one light and one space for the air, the conditioner, and
how
the
many
room.
People in one room?
Sometimes 40, sometimes 50, sometimes 30. For 12 days, I sleep like between one girl and my front and my back, like this, vertical. Just one lady, she was pregnant, she sleep like laid down. No windows, the toilet is no door. I stayed there for 22 days, no shower, no absorbent for a period, no treatment for like hurts and legs or nothing. It was the same food. It was one bread in the morning and the 3 like cookie, like peanuts cookie at night. The same food for 22 days. We eat it like crying, look at everybody. We have to eat for you can feel hungry.
But Michelle was about to get an unexpected break. According to U.S. law, non-Mexican immigrants cannot be deported to their home countries without an immigration hearing. But officials say there just isn't enough room to accommodate the hundreds of immigrants arriving in the U.S. each day. So after spending 22 days locked up in a holding cell, Michelle was released. She was given an ID bracelet and a court date for her immigration hearing in California, the place she was headed to. But Michelle's day in court never came. According to her lawyer, her ID number was non-existent and her case got lost in the system. To this day, Michelle has not received a notice to appear in court. She holds down 2 jobs, one as a nanny and another as a restaurant hostess. Most of the money she earns, she sends back to her family in Brazil.
My dreams is what? Going back to Brazil with good English and... My dream is be legal here. It's not good when you want to go in some place you can't go, and I don't want to do fake documents. You know, I want to be like, I want to go whatever I want to go, I can't go. So I think like why when I say I want to be legal here is because I work for this country, you know, and I work hard, and I know I can help them with my work. And I want a Pentax because I want to be legal here. But how I'm going to pay tax if I don't have documents?
For Making Contact, I'm Stefana Petrova.
And while debates continue in the streets, in the media, and in the halls of Congress about immigration reform, so does the debate between immigrants who entered the U.S. legally and those who did not. Making Contact's Esther Mania went to Miami to talk to immigrants to find out how they feel on the issues of immigration and citizenship.
Waving tiny U.S. flags, 3,000 immigrants crowd into Miami's convention center to become America's newest citizens. They place their right hands over their hearts and recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
One nation.
Under God.
Under God. Indivisible.
With liberty and justice for all.
Liberty and justice for all.
Among the many Cubans here is 41-year-old A.C. Sampa. She says when she was 24, she arrived in the U.S. with her father, who had been a political prisoner. Sampa says she entered the U.S. legally, and she thinks everyone who immigrates here should follow the law.
The people who come here want to be with their families, but they should do it legally, not by coming over by sea illegally. I don't agree with that.
But Sampa says she feels conflicted about proposed immigration policies that would separate undocumented immigrants from their families. During the ceremony, a color guard marches past the new citizens. They watch a video with their new president. George W. Bush congratulates them on their long journey. 20 years ago, Blanca Lopez headed north from Nicaragua through Mexico and illegally crossed the U.S. border by foot.
I trespassing the big lake, Rio Grande. It's very difficult when I trespassing because it's very dangerous. Because sometimes the people die and the people run because say the Mexican coming and maybe you die, no?
Lopez says she risked her life to escape a civil war and becoming a U.S. citizen is like a dream come true. But some feel torn between their patriotism for their new country, the U.S., and a love for their mother country.
Germany, Guyana, Haiti.
They cheer when a speaker asks them to stand to represent their country one last time. With her certificate in hand, Elka Gooden leaves the building as a new U.S. citizen. But she says borders between countries are ultimately irrelevant.
This is God's land here, God's land there. Everywhere is just for one man make this land, God.
52-year-old Gooden was a seamstress in Jamaica. Now she's a nurse in Miami with two houses, what she calls the American dream.
I came here legal. People came here and vote. They came here in other people's name. If that's the reason for me, if that's the way I would get to America, believe me, I wouldn't be here. Because I'm afraid of seeing the police putting a handcuff on my hand and thrown behind bars. I would be so embarrassed.
During the past few months, proposed immigration reform has stirred up heated public debates. Immigrants, new and old, took to the streets in massive numbers. But opinions among immigrants vary, depending on who you talk to, where they came from, and how they got here. In the heart of Little Havana, Cuban Americans gather every day and night at one of Miami's most popular restaurants, Versailles. Brightly lit with chandelier lamps and artsy mirrors, people wait to be seated. Versailles is often referred to as the meeting hub for Cuban exiles.
They come here to talk. The Cuban like to talk too much.
Standing just outside is 75-year-old Ramon Martinez. He was once a professor and then a clerk for Coca-Cola. He came to the U.S. with a visa and only 10 cents in his pocket. Martinez was soon granted political asylum. He's one of many Cuban Americans that have benefited from generous U.S. immigration policies towards Cubans. In 1994, President Bill Clinton signed the Cuban Migration Agreement. This policy says once Cubans step foot on U.S. soil, they're allowed to stay, and eventually become legal U.S. citizens.
You arrive here, you go on the boat, you arrive here, you put your feet in the land, no problem.
The same policy says if Cubans are caught at sea by immigration agents, they're detained, then deported back to Cuba. This so-called wet-foot, dry-foot policy has been controversial. Critics say some Cubans receive special treatment because of their politics. Travel just 10 miles north of Little Havana to Little Haiti, a home to many Haitian immigrants since the 1970s. Here, people like Marlene Bastian question why undocumented Cuban immigrants are allowed to stay in this country while Haitians are sent back.
Haiti is 10 times more of a dangerous place than Cuba right now. Haitians are being deported back.
Bastian says in Haiti she was politically outspoken. Her father feared for her life, and at 22, she migrated to the U.S. Now, as a U.S. citizen, she continues to advocate on behalf of Haitian immigrants' rights and offers an easy remedy to the ongoing immigration debate.
Giving green cards to immigrants makes sense. It makes good sense, good economic and security sense. When people become residents, permanent residents, they're not afraid anymore. They feel more stable. They invest, they buy homes, because they don't have to worry every minute of being snatched and shackled in front of their kids and dragged to the detention center.
Southwest of Miami, hundreds of Haitians are held at the Chrome Detention Center. Bastian once volunteered there as an interpreter and vowed to make a difference. In 1991, she helped found Haitian Women of Miami, also known as FOM. The Social Service Center is devoted to empowering Haitian women and their families. Speaking in Creole, Bastian meets with children at FOM's daycare center. Here, the kids play chess and rehearse for a fashion show. One of the children, Katiana Desarnes, is just 9 years old and already has strong feelings about the immigration debate.
I've heard that people been crying for papers. Sometimes they put them in jail or they deport them to their other country that they were born to. And I want to say so that God could please give them papers so they could live in country.
For Katiana's family and millions of immigrants in the U.S., the future remains uncertain. What is certain is that the immigration debate continues to stir strong feelings, sometimes contradictory, among this country's newest Americans.
That was Making Contact's Esther Mania. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, Steve Macer, and mixing engineers Philip Babich and Mike Lamar. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 3706, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Dorian Taylor communications manager, and I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.